From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
After two summits, what's been decided? What has not? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Obama hosted back-to-back summits from Friday at Camp David until today in Chicago. The G8 agreed that Greece should stay in the Eurozone, but the battle over growth versus austerity is far from over. NATO countries will pull out of Afghanistan by the end of 2014, but will they provide the funding required for local police and a national army? Are such meetings all that useful? Did the president get what he wanted? Will the U.S. have to live with continued uncertainty in a rapidly changing world? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Congress zeroes in on the U.S. Census. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. After thousands of protesters clashed with police this weekend, many Chicago businesses encouraged workers to stay home today. Meantime, at the convention center, NATO leaders agreed to pull troops out of Afghanistan by the end of 2014, with President Obama insisting that stabilizing that country is still a vital priority. The NATO meeting came hard on the heels of the G8 summit Friday and Saturday at Camp David, which supported the president's call for growth as opposed to austerity in the Eurozone. Tony Caron is senior editor at Time magazine. Tony Caron, good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren.
Somewhat ambiguous results from both of these summits. What does it tell us, if we can draw some conclusions, about the role of the United States now in the global environment, which is changing so rapidly?
Well, I think in both instances, what you're seeing is that these are symptoms of a diminishment of U.S. power. The U.S. still remains the sole superpower. It remains the first among equals. It's definitely far more powerful militarily and economically than any other country in the world. But the sense of global leadership that the U.S. was able to apply through institutions like the G8 and NATO has clearly diminished now. The rise of other powers and the fact that many of the partners of the U.S. and the U.S. itself in those institutions are less able to impose their will and to project power and influence in other parts of the world.
Why is this true of the United States itself?
Well, I think, you know, domestically one can see the economic slowdown would probably be a major reason. The U.S. simply doesn't have the resources to keep committing to the sort of global influence in the way that it has done, but also that the politics of you know, imposing order through force, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have not been particularly successful in that respect, and that you have the rise of other poles, that you have a lot of countries in the middle who are traditional U.S. allies but are starting to hedge their options, that they can have relations with China, they can have relations with Russia. You look at countries like Brazil or Turkey and you see, you know, these guys have relations with the U.S., but they also have relations with the countries that the U.S. considers enemies.
And that, you think, got in the way in both of these instances at Camp David, and in Chicago?
Well, I think in Camp David you see a situation where capital markets make the fates of all of these governments very closely connected, but there's no consensus among them or basis for achieving such a consensus. And there's no, you know, nothing that happens at the G8 has any teeth. It's not as if, you know, Angela Merkel, who perhaps is relatively isolated as an advocate of austerity, comes away from that needing to change her policies. So, you know, essentially everybody else is pleading with her to you know, change the orientation of Germany. But it's going to be up to Germany to decide that. I think in the case of Afghanistan, NATO, you sort of see NATO's an institution that perhaps has outlived its purpose, which was restraining the Soviet Union. NATO was created as an alliance to save Western Europe from the possibility of Soviet conventional military strength actually overrunning all of Western Europe. So you needed the sort of set of arrangements that linked in everybody's mutual defense. But at the moment, at the point at which the Soviet Union collapsed, it really, you know, a big question mark hung over NATO. And you've had this sort of expansion, but the purpose has become more and more blurry. You had the operations in the Balkans, you know, in a sense of common purpose, but even that, something somewhat murky. And then Afghanistan, perhaps, even more so, that it's not even the most efficient way of making, undertaking these kind of operations. NATO's got that more war by consensus model. And also the Europeans are simply not committed, in terms of resources and so on, to expeditionary warfare.
Tony Caron again, senior editor at Time magazine. Paula Neuberg is director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Paula Neuberg, always good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon.
What about the situation in Afghanistan? To what extent do you think the European powers are committed there, particularly after troops are withdrawn at the end of 2014? There's no question that Afghanistan is going to need a great deal of outside help in order to maintain not just local police, but, of course, the army that is supposed then to protect the citizens of Afghanistan from another takeover by the Taliban.
I would actually go even further. I mean, what you've said is absolutely true, and I would answer your first question by saying no matter what people say in a summit meeting, you will see how they act later on, and a lot of how they act will have to do with both their fiscal solvency and the degree to which they see their contributions being used to purposes that they actually believe will work. But beyond that, Afghanistan actually confronts a potential economic and humanitarian crisis that is of a different sort. It's a human security problem and not just a military security problem. What the same actors who are part of NATO have been doing is contributing in ways to the Afghan economy that is a kind of trickle-down economics in a way. And with the departure of the troops, a large portion of Afghanistan's budget may well go. A lot of the jobs will go, and no one quite knows what that is going to look like.
So the economy then depends, to a certain extent, on the occupation.
It does. 92% of Afghanistan's budget is paid for with foreign monies in one way or another. That's an enormous amount. And when you think about who has supported the military endeavors, that's where the money has come. And so you've got lots of problems, not the least of which is that a lot of the monies have gone to places that have been or seem to be most insecure, not necessarily those that have been poorest. And yet, as a whole, the administration of the country is still almost nascent. It's weak and not universal and not well organized.
So the NATO leaders say this will be an irreversible transition, that they are getting out. Some indicated that they want to get out sooner rather than later, particularly the newly elected leader of France, Monsieur Hollande. How important, Paula Neuberg, is that?
I think it's inevitable. I mean, you've had other troops already leaving. I mean, the Germans have been talking about, the Canadians, the British. I mean, this has been a subject of discussion for some time. It's the Americans that have been most keen about setting what would appear to be a date that everyone can sign on to. But given what economies look like, and frankly looking at the way that many European governments see Afghanistan, which is like a sinking ship in a sense, it's no surprise that they're going to want to leave earlier rather than not. And I think the critical question to ask, and one that I can't answer, is whether leaving earlier makes a huge amount of difference. In other words, what these plans that Americans are so well known for making, what they actually mean on the ground.
There has been some indication that President Obama, in his reelection campaign, doesn't want Americans to think that the United States is abandoning Afghanistan. Republicans, who, after all, under George W. Bush, started the war, have been raising that issue. Do you think politics is playing a major part?
Politics plays a part in everything that has to do with an election year. But going beyond the Republicans, it's President Obama who campaigned on the idea that this was a good war. And it's really hard to bicycle back on that also.
So it's no longer just a Republican war, obviously. He's stuck with it.
He stuck with it. He orchestrated the surge. It's under his watch that engagement has expanded, not necessarily all in bad ways. But this is a war that is owned bipartisanly, and it's one that's going to have to be defended or dissected in a bipartisan fashion as well.
Paula Neuberg again at the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Philip Golub is a contributing editor of Le Monde Diplomatique. That's a French journal based in Paris. He is the author of Prestige, A History of American Imperial Expansion. Philip Golub, good to have you back on our program.
Hi.
How important do you think is the French indication that it will withdraw before 2014? How likely is it then that France will contribute to the police and military presence that is so important to President Obama in the aftermath of the NATO withdrawal?
Look, you know, I mean, generally speaking, the European participation, with the exception of the United Kingdom, was insignificant in Afghanistan. France's participation right now is approximately at 3,000 troops, of which maybe half of that are combat troops, special forces mainly. But the French forces have not been engaged in major combat operations recently. So I actually think that, objectively speaking, the withdrawal of French forces is not going to change anything on the ground. I think in Paris, as well as in all other capitals, and that includes Washington, nobody believes that Afghanistan can be saved. Afghanistan is a lost cause. And what President Obama is probably trying to do is to create a decent interval, an expression that was used for the last phase in Vietnam, to be able to withdraw with some kind of elegance. Afterwards, what happens to Afghanistan and to the Afghan state will be probably a matter for the Afghan people themselves. This probably implies some kind of negotiation with the Taliban or with elements of the Taliban, which have been ongoing for some time, as a matter of fact. I think, generally speaking, the Europeans right now are stuck in what for them is a much more dramatic and much more immediate crisis, which is the crisis of the Eurozone, the problem of the financial institutions within the Eurozone, and the crisis of what is called, what has been called, the peripheral states of the European Union, and in particular Greece. Germany's policies on these issues, on the European crisis, have provoked a worsening of conditions throughout the continent, which may now lead to, or are leading to, a potential euro breakup. So the Europeans are concentrated on their economic, fiscal, and social problems rather than on world problems. NATO is not the most crucial issue for Europe right now.
So obviously then, these two things are very much related, the meeting of the G8 and the meeting of the NATO countries, many of which are in the G8.
Yes, they're related. I mean, the point was made before, I think you made the point, Warren, that American legitimacy, or one of your guests made the point that American legitimacy and power in the world was declining. I think that statement can be broadened to say that Western power, or Euro-Atlantic power, has globally declined over the past 10 to 15 years. I think that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were accelerating factors rather than causative factors in that. And what we are seeing is a configuration in which the economic situations and financial situations, and therefore the social circumstances in which the Atlantic powers find themselves, has deteriorated quite significantly. And in the midst of this crisis, on neither side of the Atlantic is there the will or the capacity to actually establish any kind of reasonable world order. In coming years, Europe and the United States are going to have to find ways both to solve their internal, their domestic problems, economic and social problems, as well as to deal with the question of the emergence or reemergence of China, India, Brazil, and other former post-colonial states or former colonial states. This is a very complex transition to negotiate. And I'm not quite sure whether you have the vision. In any case, in Europe, you don't have a unified vision as to how to deal with these challenges conjointly. Europe, to a very great extent, is looking inwards rather than outwards, and is looking inwards in ways which are likely going to weaken Europe in future rather than to strengthen it. I cannot restate how much the current fiscal discipline and austerity policies in Europe are hampering a growth-oriented strategy of exit from the crisis. President Hollande in France has some kind of commonality with President Obama on this issue. They probably see more eye to eye than they do with Mrs. Merkel. But the problems now in Europe are becoming intractable because of the German-led austerity policies that are being implemented today.
Let us turn back for the moment. We're talking with Philip Golub again at Le Monde Diplomatique. Let us turn back for the moment to the situation with regard to Afghanistan and how what it dramatizes with regard to the Western powers. Martin Butcher is arms control advocate. He writes the blog NATO Monitor. Martin Butcher, it's good to have you on our program.
Good to join you, Warren.
Let me ask you this. One of the issues with regard to Afghanistan is, of course, whether Pakistan will agree to reopen the supply routes that it has closed out of a peak of anger at the U.S. And the things that and the capture of, and killing of Osama bin Laden, the use of the drones to kill others in that country. At the NATO summit, the president of Pakistan, Mr. Zardari, was invited, but he didn't go along with the idea of reopening those routes. How important is that, do you think, in light of what we've been hearing about the decline of the Western powers being able to get what they want?
Well, it seems to me that the main factor at the moment for this is one of cost. I mean, NATO has managed using northern routes through Russia and other countries to keep supply levels up, but because everything has to come in by air, it's extremely expensive. I'm not clear why the negotiations that were ongoing about reopening the routes through Pakistan from the south have seemingly come to nothing over the last couple of days, but clearly something has gone wrong. President Obama's refusal to meet with President Zardari, and also the same refusal by the Secretary General Rasmussen of NATO, is an obvious signal of something bad in that relationship. So it's going to cost NATO a lot of money, but in the slightly longer term, as NATO starts to withdraw troops and equipment from Afghanistan, that it's going to be a much, much bigger problem. And a lot of this heavy equipment you can't take out by air, or you could only do it exceptionally slowly and at great cost. So it is a real problem for NATO. It's a choke point in the supply lines, and they need to get this sorted.
Paula Newberg, quickly back to you. Isn't part of the problem that Pakistan is demanding an apology from the United States, which the United States refuses to give?
That's one of many, many elements. But I would hasten to add that, in a sense, the problem in the relationship between the United States and Pakistan is much deeper than any one of the issues that have come up in the last year. And in a way, both the apology and the NATO through line, as well as many, many other things that have happened, really are symptoms of a relationship that is sort of off its moorings, but also is almost inevitably off its moorings. Pakistan is becoming a different place. It sees the United States becoming a different place. And Pakistan believes that the United States, NATO, its member states, are all leaving Afghanistan and leaving Pakistan there, which they have done before in different ways, and that the Pakistanis should have a greater say in what happens. But it's not the only thing that's happening, but I think there's more of an explanation that is deeper than most American commentary has sought to try to illuminate.
When NATO is gone, won't Pakistan have the opportunity to exert its power in Afghanistan? It's certainly a stronger country.
It's not so clear that what Pakistan, minus certain generals, really wants is to exert its power over Afghanistan as much as to find a way to live in the neighborhood. And since the neighborhood is very fluid, and so much of what happens in both Afghanistan and Pakistan affect each other as well, I think the Pakistanis, by their very nature, may sound more irritated than they are uncertain, but I suspect they are more uncertain than they are irritated.
When you say live in the neighborhood, you're talking particularly about India?
No, I'm actually thinking of Southwest and Central Asia.
So we're going to have to take a break, but can you quickly indicate in what ways other countries we haven't talked about are involved in this complex situation?
Well, if you take Afghanistan as the complex situation, it's surrounded by seven countries and a short water ride to the Gulf as well. And every one of those countries has been meddling in Afghanistan and has allowed factors in Afghanistan to meddle in in them for decades and decades now. So this is not one country's problem. This is everyone's problem.
Back to Tony Caron, senior editor at Time magazine. The European leaders are going to meet on Wednesday and talk further about the Eurozone. We heard earlier the phrase that what they say at the summit is one thing, what they will do later is another. That was applied to the situation in Afghanistan. But does it also apply to the situation in Europe? Is Angela Merkel going to see more pressure applied to her with regard to this issue of austerity?
Well, I think there's definitely a political backlash developing in Europe among European electorates, including her own. So there will be some pressure. I think Merkel's certainly started to talk a language of growth-oriented policies, but you know she's talking about them as a supplement to the main thrust, which for her is austerity. I think there will be some political pressure on her, but again, you know, this is a very complicated situation because these governments are not linked by some sort of structure that has any teeth in terms of taking collective decisions. It's a case of making arguments and hoping to persuade one another. And she still seems very stuck in the you know austerity as the priority.
Is that a domestic issue for her? Because when you're talking about austerity, you're talking about the fact, it seems to me, that Germany has not wanted to contribute more to the efforts to rescue Greece and perhaps even Italy, Spain and Italy and Ireland, excuse me, from economic troubles.
Well, yes, although I think in many ways that's also a question of framing. I mean, if Merkel believed in more growth-oriented policies, she could certainly make a case for you know German voters as much as anybody else that these would actually be good for everybody, that Germany's well-being has been tied to the expansion and generalization of the euro. Germany's done very well out of this policy of lending to countries on the periphery and so on. So, you know, I think it's a case also of her political preferences. She has support in the more sort of conservative austerity orientation from David Cameron, but she no longer has a partner in France.
Philip Golub, back to you, a contributing editor of Le Monde Diplomatique in Paris. How important is the fact that Angela Merkel no longer has President Sarkozy, but President Hollande to deal with?
Warren, I just wanted to tell you I also teach at the American University of Paris. I thought that was important.
It certainly is important, and I beg your pardon for leading it out. You're also the author of Prestige, A History of American Imperial Expansion. I'll include that as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think it's important that, you know, the fact that there's going to be a rebalancing since France is the second largest economy and the second most important power in Europe. Obviously, Hollande's election is going to change the dynamic somewhat in Europe. How far it's going to change that dynamic remains to be seen. That depends on you know the France's margins of maneuver. It depends on the extent to which France can try to craft, and I'm not sure if they actually have the political will to do that, some kind of Mediterranean alliance with Italy, Spain, possibly even Greece, to try to counterbalance currently dominant policies. You know, early on in the Greek crisis in 2010, when Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou was still in power, Papandreou asked Angela Merkel to try to soften somewhat the conditions of the fiscal reorganization and austerity programs that were being undertaken in Greece in the name of fiscal discipline and probity. And Angela Merkel answered at the time, this is 2010, that she definitely didn't want to do that because, and I'm citing her, we want to make sure nobody else would want this. In other words, Greece was taken as some kind of bloody example to the rest of the so-called peripheral countries of Europe to impose this generalized austerity program. So there was an intent there from the very start on the part of German conservatives, as was just pointed out, to try to impose an agenda on the rest of Europe, which is now backfiring. The backlash is quite significant. And it's not quite clear at this point whether Europe is going to find a reasonable way out of it. I mean, there are not so many solutions. Greece exiting the euro is not going to be a sustainable solution. It could possibly cause massive bank runs on in Italy and Spain, Spain first, and then Italy, and have ricochet effect throughout the rest of the European banking system, given the interdependencies of private finance in Europe. It would also have very negative political effects. What we're seeing in Europe right now is something which I think is extremely unhealthy, which is the rise of certain forms of radical nationalism, either in the form of very far-right-wing parties in France, in Greece, and elsewhere. In France, one shouldn't forget the National Front got 18% of the vote. There's now a neo-Nazi party that has risen in Greece. It's still small, but it could gain traction. There are far-right forces in the rest of Europe which can gain from current social instability. So, and you're witnessing antagonisms, political antagonisms, nationalist antagonisms reemerge. I don't want to overemphasize that point, but it could become politically poisonous in coming years if a growth strategy is not actually successfully implemented.
Again, with no teeth for making collective decisions, as was pointed out earlier by Tony Caron, you're talking about a pretty precarious situation.
Yes. I mean, either Europe moves towards a truly federal system in which you have a central bank that actually federalizes the financial sector throughout Europe, as the Federal Reserve System does in the United States, and in which Eurobonds actually provide for a continent-wide guarantees of national debts, along with certain kinds of fiscal consolidation. But at least you would have a protective cover for all of the members of the Eurozone and eventually the European Union. Or I believe you have a dynamic of fragmentation. And that dynamic of fragmentation is something that obviously nobody wants, and certainly President Obama doesn't want it, both because he's in a re-election year and it could impact on U.S. growth, but in a more fundamental way, a crisis-ridden Europe would actually destabilize the world economy and world politics for quite some time.
Philip Golub at Le Monde Diplomatique and the American University of Paris. I want to go back to Martin Butcher, again with NATO monitor, also an arms control advocate. When we hear again and again, as we have on this program, that the Western countries are losing the capacity to try to maintain world order, how much does that disturb you as an arms control advocate?
Well, it really doesn't disturb me a lot. I mean, I'm not happy when I see NATO leaders talking about NATO as, you know, a global hub with partnerships around it capable of intervening anywhere in the world. You know, one would have hoped that they had learned the lessons of a decade in Afghanistan, which, as we've been hearing from your other contributors, has really not gone very well for NATO. They're leaving, you know, more or less with the tail between their legs in a year or so, with nothing resolved. You know, Libya has been portrayed as an intervention that was absolutely successful, where everything went right. You know, Gaddafi was overthrown, but now we have a situation inside the country of terrible instability, armed militias running different towns, nothing really being resolved internally and externally, weapons proliferation out to the south of Libya into the Sahel, which has already fueled one new conflict in Mali and may fuel others in the future. So it really doesn't seem to me that this kind of intervention across the world has really been particularly successful. And even on NATO's own periphery, right there in the former Yugoslavia, where it took NATO a long time to agree to act when the war in Bosnia was going on in the 90s, you know, we still have NATO troops unable to leave Kosovo, because while the peacekeeping mission there can be well executed and can freeze the conflict, there is no political solution, and without a political solution, those troops can't leave. So if NATO at the moment, because of lack of resources, is unable to undertake more of these big interventions, I don't see that as a real problem.
You heard about the changing nature of Pakistan earlier. Pakistan, of course, is a nuclear power. What about that, and how worrisome do you find it?
Well, Pakistan is a nuclear power. It's very focused on India. India also a nuclear power. And, you know, while Western countries have stigmatized Pakistan's nuclear program. They've really given a nod and a wink to India's. You know, the U.S. has done a deal with India over a civilian nuclear program, which runs completely contrary to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which, you know, says a country should give up nuclear weapons capability before it gets a civilian program. And, you know, they've refused to do the same deal for Pakistan. And in Iran, they're masterminding a huge set of sanctions to try and stop Iran obtaining nuclear weapons. So that there are different ways of treating these different nuclear problems, and yet, you know, NATO itself has several nuclear weapons states. They're not moving particularly quickly to disarm, and they're in something of disarray. We see today in the Defense and Deterrence Posture Review that NATO has put out, they've got three separate nuclear use policies inside one alliance. So, you know, nuclear weapons are a problem wherever they are.
We started this program by talking, obviously, about the aftermath of two summits that were from Friday through today. Tody, Karen, back to you again, senior editor at Time Magazine. You indicated that you thought there was a diminishment of U.S. leadership globally, and we've heard that that's probably true of the Western powers in general. We also have heard about emerging powers, not just China, but also Brazil and others as well. Do you think there is some possibility for other alliances to form that might either compete with the G8 and NATO, or might in some way become associated with them? I guess this would be sort of sub-United Nations. Is there anything like that shaping up?
No, I don't think we're going to see a replacement multilateral institution to replace the G8, or, you know, that there'll be China will try and play the global role the United States has been playing. I don't think that's going to happen at all. But I think, you know, Ian Bremmer in his new book, the G0, the idea that essentially there's no longer a single center of power in the world, but that the emerging states are going to, the power of the pivot, he calls it, states that are actually able to have relations on economic and political, strategic and security with a number of different partners are going to be those that thrive. So if you look at the way that Turkey has conducted itself in relation to its neighborhood, in relation to issues like Iran, it shares a lot of U.S. goals. It's part of NATO. It's actually in Afghanistan. And yet it's also challenged U.S. policy in relation to Israel, in relation to Iran, in relation to managing the region. It has it's no longer going through a central Western hub as much as engaging with that, with the Western powers, but also with others. That, you know, those are going to be the countries that make the most gains out of the situation in which the Western powers' global economic and political dominance starts to ebb.
Paula Newberg, back to you with the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. Do you agree with that?
I think basically yes. I mean, I think if you start off from the premise that everything is changing everywhere, financially, politically, economically, then the pivots of power are likely to change many, many times in the coming years. And as much as both regional and global organizations believe they can lead that change, it's unlikely.
Philip Golub, back to you. Le Monde Diplomatique, the American University of Paris, and a book, the title of which I misstated. It is Power, Profit, and Prestige, A History of American Imperial Expansion. We'll get this right before we finish the program. Your take on the prospects for world order as opposed to something different.
Well, you know, I mean, the United States remains and will remain probably for some time the undisputed military leader of the world, in the sense that it spends most on its defense budgets. It has global reach. It has intervention capabilities. The real question is what is the use of such intervention capabilities today in a context of post-colonial globalization? And there's limited use, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States also will retain most of its economic position for a bit of time, maybe a decade and a half. It represents, you know, a fifth of world GDP. If growth restarts, possibly a bit more. But what is obvious is that there's a structural transformation that has been occurring. It's not sudden. It didn't suddenly happen. It's been over the past two and a half, 3 decades. It actually began earlier than that with the in East Asia, Northeast Asia, a structural transformation in which we are moving towards a multi-centric or polycentric world in which there are multiple centers of authority and decision. And the problem is what to do in between. The G8 is a club. It's an unrepresentative club. Why is Russia in the club, not China or India or Brazil, for that matter? The era of undisputed Western dominance is slowly but surely coming to an end, and that raises the question of how we collectively, East and West, North and South, can reinvent the structures of international or multilateral cooperation to solve the global problems that are forthcoming.
Martin Butcher, final question to you. Again, writing the NATO monitor, but also the arms control advocate on the program, not that others may not be arms control advocates as well. I suspect all of us ultimately are. What about the situation in Iran? There are supposed to be meetings on that coming up very soon. Do you think that Iran will, in fact, allow UN inspectors and that that situation, which has led to talk of war, will be alleviated anytime soon?
Well, things have been going a little bit better recently. As the IAEA chief, Amano, is there at the moment. He says things have been going well. There are talks coming up next week, I think, in Baghdad. It's unlikely in a U.S. election year that we're going to get a big breakthrough sort of in 2012, but what we need to do is to keep these talks going, to keep the progress moving forward slowly during this year so that next year it can be possible for President Obama to do a deal if there's a deal there to be done. And it does seem at the moment that there might be, that Iran might be ready to make some of the compromises that it will need to make, as you say, letting UN inspectors in to see some sites that haven't been seen, that on the other side, that the countries like, you know, the U.S. and the Europeans involved in these talks will be willing to see a civilian nuclear program, including some enrichment of uranium, carry on inside Iran, and that in that way we inch slowly towards a deal. I think we came closer than anybody might have liked to the idea of a war in the past few months, and people have backed away from that now. I can't think that anybody sees that it would be in the interests of external powers or any country in the region to have a major war, as a war with Iran would be in the Middle East. There are just so many ways that could go so badly wrong. So we need to look at reducing these problems through arms control methods, and I think there is a window where that might happen now.
Very quickly, do the sanctions hurt enough? Do upcoming sanctions pose enough of a threat to Iran that it would give President Obama the gift of suggesting that there might be progress before the election?
Well, I'm not sure that it's the sanctions that would do that. If anything, the sanctions strengthen the Republican Guard. They strengthen elements of the Iranian government that might not want to do a deal. They say, look, these guys outside are bullying us. You need a policy that allows both sides to climb down from the very strong positions they've taken against doing a deal, so that people back away from the problems towards a solution.
Well, thank you all so much for a very, very wide-ranging discussion. Martin Butcher, arms control advocate, writing the NATO Monitor blog. Philip Golub at the Le Monde Diplomatique and the American University of Paris, author of Power, Profit, and Prestige. Paula Newberg, director of the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. And Tony Caron, senior editor at Time Magazine. Good to have all of you on our program today. The American Community Survey provides information that helps local governments and businesses on everything from assessing health needs to locating target stores. But now the Republican-led Congress has determined that it's an expensive violation of privacy. Will the Senate go along? Back with that in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warman Ali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Florida Republican Daniel Webster says the American Community Survey, quote, intrudes on people's lives just like the Environmental Protection Agency or the bank regulators, close quote. He has persuaded Congress that it should abolish the American Community Survey. Catherine Rampell says the American Community Survey may be the most important government function you have never heard of. Catherine Rampell, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it so important?
There are so many different government agencies, public sector corporations, actual private sector corporations, you name it, that depend very much on this data. So for example, about $400 billion plus of federal money is distributed based on the numbers that come out of this annual survey. You know, how much money goes to Florida, for example, for public health, or to some area of Minnesota for education, let's say. All of those funds are distributed based on what turns up from these demographic surveys.
Now, the Republicans have argued, Mr. Webster, prime among them, that this is not only an invasion of privacy, this survey, because it's mandatory, but also that it's too expensive. Suppose it were made voluntary. What would happen then?
That's actually even more problematic in some ways. The thing that's so valuable about these data, both for, like I said, government as well as private sector companies that are using it to figure out where to locate stores and that sort of thing, is that the data are good, that they're accurate, that they tell you a lot of good information about the population of different areas and their needs. If you make the survey voluntary, it actually becomes more expensive to administer because that means that the Census Bureau has to employ more people for more man hours going out and hunting down people who didn't respond, whereas if it's mandatory, people have to respond. And because the Census Bureau is not actually getting any additional funding, or at least it doesn't look to be, rather than the Census Bureau taking those additional expensive measures to ensure that the data are good, the data will be bad. And so you'll have a lot of corporations making bad decisions, as well as, let's say, economic development organizations or governments.
Mr. Fletcher, there seems to be, I'm sorry, I keep calling him Fletcher. Mr. Webster seems to have an issue with the understanding of how the survey works. He says it's not scientific because it's random, but I take it that those who are statistical experts say that what makes it scientific is its very randomness.
Right. The way that these types of surveys work is that they take a random sample, random representative sample across the United States. You know, they don't survey everyone. The decennial census surveys everyone, but it's only a very limited set of questions. This is a much longer survey, so they're not going to send it to every household in America. They send it to about 3 million randomly chosen households, and they ask those particular places, you know, how many people do you have in the house? Do you have internet access? That sort of thing. And it's random because that way you know that you don't have any particular bias for, you know, giving the survey out to whoever is most convenient, for example, who may or may not be representative of the entire populace.
Again, we're talking with Catherine Rampell, who's an economics reporter at the New York Times, founder of the economics blog of the paper. What's been the reaction to by the business community with which the Republican Party is so associated to getting rid of the American Community Survey?
A lot of members of the business community are up in arms. I think the problem is that the congressmen who voted to defund and actually totally dismantle this survey don't realize how dependent many companies are on this information. And there are a lot of ways in which having good data about people and their needs and wants and everything else provides for a better business plan, including that, let's say you are a retailer, you're a big box store like Target or Walmart. You know, you mentioned Target earlier. and you are trying to figure out where you should actually locate your next store. The way you figure that out is based on where the population is, right? Where you might actually have stores that serve that population, and where people are in need of, you know, more diapers or whatever it is your retail store specializes in. Beyond that, companies that are looking to open up shops somewhere not only care about who their customers are, but who their potential workers are. So if they don't have good data on, let's say, how skilled potential employees are in a particular area, you know, how many of those people went to college, let's say, or how many of them, you know, are in specific occupations. That's one of the actual data points that the Census Bureau has been collecting since 1850. If they don't have good information about what workers they have, they're also going to make bad decisions and just not hire. So the business community, led by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a number of other industry groups and individual companies, have been making a lot of noise about how much they need these numbers.
So some of the questions that Daniel Webster regards as invasive, like whether the respondent is having trouble getting dressed or how long it takes to get home from work, that kind of thing, I take it, have both policy and business rationales behind them. And it's important to note, I suppose, that the although the survey is mandatory, it's also anonymous. You are not identified in any way.
That's the concern, right? That you're violating these people's privacy. But the reality is that these numbers are all anonymized when they are released to companies or academics.
So what about the Senate? It's going to take this up this week. Is the cup going to overflow into the saucer and be restrained?
It's hard to say. You know, actually, I heard this morning that the bill probably at this point won't get taken up until after the May recess, although it's not clear. Yeah, so that's been changed as far as I know. But to get to your question, you know, it's really unclear. There was a sense, at least last week when I was reporting on this, that the Senate would probably not agree to totally get rid of this survey, but maybe in conference what would happen is that, you know, when congressmen and senators are trying to figure out what actually ends up in the final bill, you know, because the bills are different in the House and the Senate, that the compromise might be, as you said, making the survey voluntary, which, as we discussed, has
even though it might cost more. Catherine Rampell, thanks a lot for being on our program. Produced today by Anna Scott with Frances Anderton and Sonia Geis. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.